this scenario differently. I realize that I have nothing to which I can respond that was presented orally today, but this court granted the appeal on two issues in this case, and so I am happy to speak to the issues. I am certainly happy to answer questions. I think that this case should be affirmed, obviously, based on the arguments in my brief, and I think that the juror issue actually is a really interesting issue. But I will take my direction from the court. If you would like me to answer questions, I will do that. If you would like to hear from me, I'm happy to talk about the case.
I agree with you that the juror issue is interesting, but I think it's the easier of the two. So I would like to hear from you on the 17-1-1.
Sure. Sure. Your Honor, I do believe that the standard of review in this case, because it's admissibility of evidence, is abuse of discretion. I also understand from Mason that statutory interpretation is a de novo review. So we're in the land of, did the court abuse its discretion, and was there an error of law? And I think that, and we look at the...
If the order book does not comply with 17-1-123, then is it almost definitionally an abuse of discretion to admit it, so doesn't it really rise or fall? If the order book met 17-123, it's admissible. If it didn't, it didn't.
I think after Waller, that's probably a safe description of the issue in this case. And I think that Judge Garrett, in his order, which is found at pages 11 through 12 of the appendix, correctly characterizes what we have in this order. We have got the presence of who the judges are who are presiding that day. We know, looking at page 13, that Judge Moon and Judge Cundiff, Judge Designate, were sitting that day, and Judge Cundiff signed off on the first order, and Judge Moon signed off after several additional orders. Judge Garrett, in looking at this order, noted that if under 17-1-123, it's sufficient that there's an order recorded in the order book on the last day of the term showing the signature of the judges who were presiding during that term, certainly this is sufficient. He actually found that it complied with Little 2.
But this isn't an end-of-term order.
It is not. In fact, the judge gave counsel an opportunity to see if there was an end-of-term order, and there was not one. And actually, I believe that what Judge Garrett, I think he was saying, you know, if that's enough, certainly this is. But under Little 2 in 17-1-123, there's also another way to comply with the statute, is a judge's signature is shown in the order book.
Well, and a textualist, purely literal reading of Romanet 2 would mean a signature anywhere in the order book, on the cover, on the back cover, front, back, any page. But if that's what it means, why do you need Romanet 1 and Romanet 3? Because it covers everything the same way.
Well, Your Honor, I think that I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, it's sort of like the burglary statute that says entry during the night is burglary, and then it says breaking and entering at any time, day or night, is burglary. There's no need for that either. There can be surplusage in statutes. There are different ways to prove this.
But there are canons that say we're supposed to avoid reading a statute to render 1 and 3 mere surplus.
Certainly so, Your Honor. But the problem in Waller was there was no judge's signature anywhere. And that's why that order was not admissible to satisfy the violent felony requirement in that case. And I think another canon of statutory construction is that we look at the plain meaning of the words. And the plain meaning of the words here are that if the judge's signature is shown in the order book. Well, we have more than that in this case.
If you look at these, there's two ways, I guess, under your theory, that we could read this. We could say that Judge Cundiff signed the Valerie Megatson Howard order and all following unsigned orders. Or we could say Judge Moon signed the Raymond Eugene Farish order and all previous unsigned orders. So,
and that is the way Judge Garrett read it.
But what is illogical about my first reading, that Judge Cundiff's signature would be meant to apply to all of the following unsigned orders?
I think simply because orders are normally signed at the conclusion of the order. And so Judge Cundiff signed off at the bottom of the Magnuson-Howard order, and Judge Moon then was responsible for the next few orders and signed off at the conclusion of those, which is over here on page 16, the Farish.
But even if Judge Petty's alternative reading of the order is correct, under your theory, it still doesn't matter because there's a signature somewhere.
There is a signature on this very page. There's a signature on the very page, on the very date. So we've got not just anywhere in the order. We actually have more than that.
But you're presuming that the judge that heard this case is either Judge Moon or Judge Cundiff.
I think that's what the order shows. I think the order shows the Judge Moon.
How do we know it wasn't one of the other judges of the 24th Judicial District?
Well, because at the beginning of this day, if I'm reading this correctly, and I think I am, on page 13, Monday, November 26th, present, Norman K. Moon, judge, present, the Honorable O. Randolph Cundiff, judge designate. Those are the two judges that were there that day. And in fact, I think, if memory serves, there's a look on page 16. That's the next day.
That day,
we've got three judges present, Judge Johnston, Judge Moon, and Judge Cundiff.
Whether it should or it shouldn't, there's nothing in 17.1.123 that actually requires that the signature in the order book be the signature of the judge who entered the order. I mean, we assume that to be the case, but does the language in the statute actually require it?
Well, I think that, yes, I think that that is consistent with number three. If we can have an order at the end of the term signed by the judges who presided during that term, irrespective of which case over which they presided, then certainly that's a consistent reading with number two. The orders in this case certainly comply with more than one requirement of 17.1.123, because we do have a signature in the order book, and we do have the that's number two. And number three, I guess really it's more what Judge Garrett said. Not that it complies with that, but certainly in looking at the statute and what's required of the statute, if that's enough. Because the purpose of the statute is to determine that these are valid orders. We've got a certification by the clerk. That's the requirement from 801.389. And then we have to look and see, are these valid orders? Were judges present? And that's clear from this record that they were.
I assume, although this may be not a valid assumption, I assume that there was an actual order entered in the record of the case in the file.
Which was, as my recollection from the record in this case, is that those were not available. The prosecutor attempted to get those.
My point is, what we're looking at is not the validity
correct.
Of the order. We're looking at the validity of the recording of the order.
Well, which I agree with you, Your Honor, and I think that under 801.389, judicial records is evidence, and that's the purpose. We're using this to enhance the charge against Mr. Hubbard, and so we're not going to enhance that charge, as Waller teaches, unless we've got a valid prior conviction. And we have a valid prior conviction based on what's in the order book, and we don't have the original orders anymore. And Judge Garrett, in this case, did not make an error of law in reviewing the statutes and the pages from the order book, and he certainly did not abuse his discretion in making the determination. So it's our position that these orders were properly admitted into evidence to support the subsequent drug offense conviction.
All right, any further questions? Thank you. We will greet counsel.
Okay, thanks.